Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, a year or so ago, I had on the show an up-and-coming novelist from South Carolina named Mark Powell, who had written five novels, mostly set in Appalachia. And they were all extremely powerful books that transcended their Appalachian roots, and we had a good interview talking about those stories and his writing life. And afterward, he told me about another Appalachian writer, who was basically his mentor and role model, named Ron Rash. I had not heard of him or his work, which really only shows that I don't read as much as I'd like to these days. I bought the book that Mark recommended called Serena and found myself reading one of those books that won't let go. It keeps you up half the night, several nights running until you finish it. The word riveting is kind of a book jacket reviewer hyperbole, but that's what it is. Serena was published in 2008 and won a slew of major awards, a New York Times bestseller. And they called it one of the greatest American novels in recent memory, which it was, I thought. Since then, I read his most recent novel, The Risen, published in 2016, which was also first rate. Author Ron Rash is my guest today. Welcome, Ron.
Glad to be with you.
Nice to have you here. I kind of hate to ask you to do this, since you've probably done it dozens of times, but can you briefly describe for our audience the storyline of Serena?
It's a story about the timber industry in the 1920s and going into the early 1930s in the Appalachian Mountains. I think a story about the attempts to create the Smoky Mountains National Park and the timber interests who were fighting it. It was based on a good bit of what actually happened in the North Carolina mountains. But I wanted it to be a book that I hoped resonated into contemporary times and our own questions about national forest and ecological matters.
Yeah, so it does all that, but boy, the characters are so powerful. I mean, you know, just without giving it away, I mean, it's kind of a love story between two very ambitious, power-hungry and money-hungry people, of whom the wife is by far the most predatory. And she's a beautiful, charismatic, but dangerous woman, you know, and so it ends up being really, really dramatic in many, many ways. I mean, it's just a very densely written book. Now, The Risen that I said I had read recently is shorter. And I would say it's lighter, but it's still an excellent read. I'd describe it as a crime thriller that revolves around two brothers and their long-ago relationship as teenagers with a seductive drug-dealing girl who disappeared, but whose corpse now turns up decades later and kind of turns their world upside down. And I'd say in both novels, the characters are very clearly and intensely drawn. And so as I mentioned, the female villain in Serena, named Serena Pemberton, gosh, she's one of the most powerful and original and really outright disturbing characters I've come across in a long time. Very believable, too, but her faithful hired killer, Galloway, is also scary and unforgettable. Here's the thing, in both novels, and Serena in particular, the sense of place is so strong, you know, like Ron mentioned a minute ago, that you practically smell and feel it. And the landscape is itself a pervasive character in the story. Ron, I get the feeling you spent a lot of time outdoors in the mountains and woods growing up, did you?
I did, and particularly in the area around Boone, North Carolina. My grandmother had a farm there, and it bordered the Blue Ridge Parkway. So as a child and in my early teens, I was pretty much just allowed to run, go wherever I wanted to. So I spent a lot of time there. I got to hear the voices of the people and a sense of the landscape. And I've always been a writer of landscape, which I find in no way limiting. Because I would argue that most of the great novels are regional novels. There's a novel no more regional than Ulysses. It takes place in 24 hours in Dublin. Sometimes I think that the regional label can sound limiting, but I find it in no way that way. As Eudora Welty once said, one place understood helps us understand all places better.
Yeah, many of my listeners are in Florida, and many of them have read A Land Remembered by Patrick Smith, and that was his, I guess, first of a series of books set in central Florida for the most part, and they're, you know, described as regional books, but the same thing. They're just excellent books that are universal in character, and they happen to be in a place. Well, you know, other than science fiction or something, what book isn't in a place? I think, you know, when you really describe the place very densely and richly, it basically connects with the characters and connects with the reader, you know, and I think you do that very well.
Yeah, I think it even becomes a character in some ways in books.
Yeah.
It, starts to have its own sense of force and impact on the characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, the human characters.
Yeah, as I said earlier, it was like a real character in the story, and you kind of, you're aware of the people and their personalities, but you're also aware of the surroundings because you've written it so well that, you know, like I said, you can kind of smell the woods. I think even though originally you were described as an Appalachian regional writer, pretty quickly critics and reviewers seem to have realized that was a gross understatement. You know, given the fact that they really are, your books are universal, like we were just talking about, how do you describe your genre when you're forced to wear a label? What do you say you are?
That's always tough, and particularly when you start getting into the, you know, the idea of being the Southern writer or the, you know, the Appalachian writer. I guess what I would say, I guess I'm trying to do what I think most serious writers are trying to do. What does it mean, or what does it feel like to be alive in the world? And I hope that when I, even when I write about the past, I'm simultaneously writing about the present. The work I love, as I say, you know, may enter a particular time or place, but ultimately, if it works, it's the universality of it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just divorcing it from the idea of place, you know, Appalachia or South or whatever, I think I said that The Risen I thought was more like a crime thriller. Would you say that Serena, I mean, it was very dramatic. Would you say that was a thriller to some extent, or is that understating it?
I would say it has those elements. I actually, one thing I was trying to do in that book was to write a kind of Elizabethan drama. And if you've read Shakespeare, Marlowe, Thomas Kidd, all of those writers, their books, I mean, they are very dramatic. They're at times very violent. And that's what I kind of wanted. I want the reader to be to have a sense of a story being dramatic and dramatic events occurring. And I think one reason that writers tend to write about those very dramatic moments, moments that you might read in a thriller, is that that's when character is truly revealed. A human being can hide most of his or her life, not showing who that person really is. But once in very intense situations, usually character's revealed. And we see that in life, in those moments when people we know surprise us, sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad. To me, that's the ultimate reason for the drama, is to reveal human character.
As realistic and as really gritty realistic as what I've read of your work so far is, there's also a hint of what I would, I guess, call kind of otherworldliness sometimes that creeps into the books, and it actually comes in a way that's believable and realistic, right? But I saw it described somewhere as magical realism, which is like that of the, you know, the famous South American author Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So is that sense of otherworldliness kind of embedded in the Appalachian worldview, or is it just you?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. You know, my family's been in the mountains up here about 200 years, so certainly that world and the folklore has been a part of my life. But yeah, I think there's always a sense when I write that the world is maybe more mysterious than we think it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the idea that all of its secrets have not revealed. You know, for instance, when an animal that's been declared extinct suddenly reappears. Mm-hmm. I also hope that my work works on a number of levels. And so I think as I kind of try to, in some ways, achieve the mythic, that we start to move into that place where, definitely in Serena, where you start to sense elements of magical realism, that the world is suddenly becoming much more mysterious than perhaps we, you know, early in the book we might have thought. It's a complex blend of realism and myth and otherworldliness, as you say, you know, the hope is that it works.
Yeah. The character of Serena is so, if that individual were real, and there may from time to time be people like her, if she were real, her character is so strong that I think she uses elements of supernaturalism in her dealings with the world, maybe. You know, that sounds a little odd to say, but you'd have to read the book, right?
So. Yeah, but I think you're right. I mean, I think certainly the longer start to see her as being, having a kind of otherworldly power, no doubt about that.
Yeah, larger than life. Yeah, they were scared to death of her, basically.
And that was one of the, you know, once I really got into the book, it wasn't that I went into the book wanting to do this, but I did think as I got deeper into the book that it would be interesting to have a woman at a time in the 1920s, for instance, who, mm-hmm. where normally a woman might have power, but it normally would be almost within a family or in that kind of dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
To have a woman who essentially... or not, you know, who, yeah, does rule over, say, 100 men and completely controls them. I thought that, to me, was an interesting premise, and to see how the men would react.
Yeah, and these weren't delicate men. I mean, to say that these were loggers far out in the mountains. These were tough guys, you know, and she had an iron grip on the whole thing pretty quickly.
Quickly shows she knows more about their job than they know, and actually best one of them early on in a contest. I thought that, to me, was an interesting dynamic to the book, was how their reaction to her, they come with certain assumptions of a woman at this time and place, and then those assumptions quickly subside.
That's right. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Ron Rash about his books that are set in Appalachia. We've been talking in particular about one called Serena, and his most recent one called The Risen. You know, both those novels, Ron, remind me of the work of Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides and other great novels. He was a South Carolina writer. He passed away in March 2016. Did you know him?
I did. He was a good friend, a very generous man, larger than life. just one of the funniest people I've ever met, but also one of the kindest. And I really, really miss him. We had a good friendship, and I always look forward to those kind of calls that he would call, not just to me, but to a number of people, and you'd hear that great booming voice sometimes at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, is it up to me to keep this dying friendship alive? He would always start with that.
And you go, well, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I feel like I'm dying, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's always worth it. I didn't mind getting up for any phone call from Pat.
There you go. What other novelists have influenced and shaped you? There's a standard interviewer question for you.
Well, that's an important question. I think certainly Dostoevsky was the first who really, really made me want to be a writer. I read him when I was too young to really understand him on many levels. But when I was 14, I read Crime and Punishment. And as I've said before, I'd always entered a book, but that was the first book that entered me. I mean, I really felt like that was almost an out-of-body experience, the intensity of that novel. And even at 14, I got a good bit of that. So he remains one of my heroes. I read Shakespeare all the time. I love Shakespeare. The more I read him, the more I don't understand how any human being could have written on that level.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other writers, certainly... Cormac McCarthy is a writer. Faulkner, of course. Joyce. Marquez certainly is a writer. A great French writer, not that well known in the United States, John Junot, who writes very much about rural France in the early part of the 20th century. He's one of my very favorite novelists as well.
Did you ever read any Peter Matheson?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And Killing Mr. Watson is a wonderful. Those books,
that whole series.
Certainly, mm-hmm. And The Snow Leopard. Yeah, he's an amazing writer, and I certainly learned a lot from him.
How do you get started on a novel? You know, where does the original idea come from? Is this sort of pops into your mind while you're taking a shower, or how does that work?
Well, it usually doesn't even start as an idea. It usually starts with an image. Serena started with an image of a woman on horseback. I knew that she was very strong, and I knew that she was very sure of herself, and also realized someone was watching her, and it was kind of like a, you know, an old Polaroid picture that's very slowly developing, but I realized that someone was looking at her with love, but also fear.
That may have been her husband.
Yes, and actually that moment comes about midway, right in the middle of the novel, but I usually start with an image. And then kind of the voices come, and I never know where the novel's going to go. And that's the scary part. I'll usually be in about a year in a novel, and it will suddenly just almost evaporate.
Oh, no.
And that's when I have this horrible period where it happens with every novel, where I'll go, you know, sometimes a couple of weeks, sometimes a couple of months, and just want to give up, or do give up in some ways. And then something will come. and suddenly it'll revive.
Hmm. So I guess that's happened enough that you can at least trust that that's going to happen and you're not totally terrified that you've lost it.
Right. I mean, there is, the fact that I've done it before, but I never outline, I never, plot. So I really don't know where it's going. And in a way, I kind of wish I did. I think writers that can do that are luckier because you don't have to have that fear that maybe this is just a dead end. But but somehow it works out.
So you really don't know where it's going. I mean, it's just like it's like a spring flowing and keeps on flowing and suddenly it dries up and you go, oh my Lord.
Yeah, wow. I have to kind of wait out the characters and let them reveal more to me. And that's, to me, the most mysterious part about writing is how very often it feels not so much that I'm creating as transmitting something, that's being told to me.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. It's almost like channeling. I mean, does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, and other writers have talked about this. Stephen King talks about it. It's not so much that you create it, you find it.
Yeah.
But who put it there?
Yeah. You're just trying to write fast and keep up with it, huh?
Yeah, that's what happens when it's really coming. It's a race, but somehow it always seems to work out.
Well, you've written 6 novels. And tell me if I'm wrong about these numbers. 6 collections go ahead.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
6 collections of short stories and 5 books of poetry. So I'm pretty sure novels sell better than short stories, which in turn sell better than poetry. But which do you enjoy writing the most?
I enjoy the short story form the most, and in part because I find it the most difficult to do well. Mm-hmm. If you talk to most writers who do both, I think they'll agree that to write a good short story is harder than write a good novel.
Yeah, I've read that a lot too. Kind of like maybe the difference between a 100-yard dash and a marathon or something.
That's a good analogy because I ran track in high school and college, and even after college I ran AAU, and I was an 800-meter runner. So I think in a way that is emblematic of where I am as a writer. The short story form requires the concision of poetry and a sense of a narrative fulfillment of a novel, at least on some level. And to do those things well, as someone such as Flannery O'Connor does, who probably does it as well as any writer I know, is a real balancing act.
It sounds like you enjoy short stories, and it's also the hardest to do. But when you've done them all, when you've done a novel and you've done a short story and you've written a poem, in general, I mean, I'm sure that each one has its own individual personality and feel for you, but in general, which particular work out of all you've done is your personal favorite? Is that easy to say?
I would say probably Serena's the novel I'm proudest of.
Yeah, I wouldn't blame you.
And it's because in some ways it's the most ambitious. It did what I wanted it to do. I really felt good about that one. My book of short stories, I have a selected short stories, a larger book called Something Rich and Strange, but I have a collection that was published just as 12 stories called Burning Bride. And I felt like in those stories, that was probably when I felt like I'd done the best I could.
Okay, audience, Burning Bright is another one. So Serena was made into a movie starring Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. What was that experience like? Did you get involved in the making of the movie?
No, I didn't. I stayed away from it. Actually, Pat Conroy gave me good advice on that. He said, they're not going to listen to you anyway. I didn't read the screenplay or anything. And I was disappointed with the adaptation, but that's okay. It brought some readers to the book that wouldn't have come before. And I got a little money on to help with my mortgage.
Well, I hope you got more than a little money.
Well, not a lot. I mean, it's funny. People might think you get a lot of money, but writers don't get the big money.
Yeah, sure. You said you were a little disappointed with it, but did you feel the movie captured your book even reasonably well, or was it, in your mind, if you can say it, was it a total, snafu?
Well, I thought one of the problems was with Serena, if you've read the book, so you know what she's like. They turned her into a kind of a whimpering woman who was ready to die for love. And, the whole point of the book was just the opposite.
Really? Ay, ay, ay. All right, listeners out there, stick to the book, forget the movie.
Yeah.
he probably doesn't make a dime when you watch the movie anyway. So Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And as I said earlier, we're talking with author Ron Rash, who is a writer of many novels and many collections of short stories and books of poetry. You know, fewer people, Ron, as you probably know, read these days, at least anything longer than a Twitter feed. And, you know, a lot of authors, even some I've had on the show, self-publish, which used to be an embarrassing thing, but is not so much anymore because it's difficult to find a reputable publisher, you know, with a smaller readership. There's not as much money in that industry as there used to be. Did you have trouble breaking in with a legitimate publisher at first when you were starting out?
I did. I didn't get published by a major publisher until I was almost 50. I was publishing with smaller regional publishers, but they did beautiful books, and I kept writing, and I think sometimes it's a good thing not to get published early. I don't think I was writing that well, and I think when the book started to get published, it was at a time when I had written enough and learned enough to where I could write something I could feel good about afterwards.
Well, I imagine it's a two-way street. By the time you got your skill all under your belt and were hitting your stride, your books were better, then they became more attractive to publishers too, right? So
That's true. And but I never, you know, I never really got that discouraged. I just decided that I wanted to do this, and my hope was that I might get a few books published and that would be enough. So if whatever else happens is is a kind of gift, and
yeah, it's up to fate. Well, like a lot of successful authors, you teach. You teach at Western Carolina University in Asheville, North Carolina, where, oddly enough to me, you're a professor of Appalachian Studies. I was kind of surprised that you don't teach creative writing as such. Was that choice even one that you had? Or, you know, if so, was it a hard one, a hard choice to make, or was it kind of natural for you to teach Appalachian Studies?
It was partly the endowed chair allowed me to teach writing courses as well, but I have taught a class on Appalachian literature, which I enjoyed. I was doing programs, bringing in historians, ecologists, musicians that to talk about, you know, discuss the region. But at the same time, I do teach a fiction writing class. I don't call it creative writing because I don't think anyone can teach creativity, but I do call it fiction writing, and I'm actually doing that this semester.
Oh, okay. But when you teach Appalachian Studies as such, I mean, often you're teaching more like history and culture, right? It's not writing.
Absolutely.
At all.
Absolutely. Yeah, though the literature is a part of it as well, of course, yeah.
Well, how do you, you know, given all these other demands on your time, Ron, how do you write? What's your work style for writing?
Well, I was free this summer, so that helped a lot, and I didn't have anything I really had to do besides write. So I wrote, you know, every day, but I find ways. I tend to write in the mornings if I try to teach afternoons or evenings. I like to have a rhythm to my day. I exercise, I write, and I teach. So I try to do the same thing every day. And I think that's probably important for people who want to write, particularly write a novel. It's more like being a mule than a racehorse. And it's a matter of some days the writing doesn't come easily, but those are the days when I go in and I'd rather, as I tell people, stick pencils in my eyes than try to write. But then it kind of comes. I'll wait a few minutes, sometimes 30 minutes, and something will come, and then I'll start. And, you know, some of the best days I've ever had were days when I went in thinking, I'm not going to be able to write a sentence today.
What do you do when you actually sit down and you can't write a sentence today? Do you just sort of keep doodling until the stream starts flowing, or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of almost, well, I'm either going to write or I'm going to torment myself by just sitting here. And it's probably not the healthiest way to do it, but as I say, probably almost always something will come. Yeah. But I mean, I won't be checking email or anything. I'll be sitting and have a pad in front of me and computer nearby to, you know, if I do start typing. But I usually have something that I can work on.
Do you have more than one work in progress at a time? We're kind of getting toward the end of the show here, but you know, do you have maybe a short story that if you can't proceed with a novel, you set that aside for a minute and start trying on the short story, or what?
I do. Yeah, that's exactly what I tend to do. I'll have a short story I need to tinker with, or I'll have if I'm working on short stories, usually between drafts of a novel. So I kind of go back and forth and try to have something ready. So that when I am writing, or when I have the time to write, I am writing.
So we do just have a minute or so left, Ron, but, you know, so here's a question I hope you can answer kind of briefly, we'll see. But being based in East Tennessee here at East Tennessee State University and WETS, I've focused on different aspects of Appalachian culture in a number of my shows, and it's clear to me that mountain people have always been kind of tough and self-reliant. Do you see Appalachian culture, since you teach that, as following the more mainstream East Coast American culture, only lagging it, you know, in time and just being behind? Or is it pursuing its own independent path in many ways?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Obviously, the region has problems, certain particular problems. I mean, we've had, you know, but at the same time, we have success. And I try to write in my work. One of my goals, and if I don't do this, I fail, is that I might show the people living in the region, and they have different customs, they speak differently, maybe have different educational levels. But if a reader in another country or another part of the United States cannot recognize that these people are ultimately going through the same important, I mean, the things that all human beings do, you know, love and fear and hate, pity.
Sure.
You know, the danger is you either demonize them or you sentimentalize them, you know, but if you don't realize that they're just human beings, ultimately, despite the circumstances, you fail. So I'm always a little skeptical of generalizations, though at the same time, you know, with the family's roots in the area, I know that there are just certain aspects of the culture that are distinct from the rest of the country, and I'm very proud of those in many ways. The language, the music, certainly, the food, and so I think it's always that point where the writer wants to achieve what's true of the region, and at the same time, never let the reader forget that these are human beings that, in many ways, ultimately are everywhere.
The one thing that kind of puts it in a nutshell for me, that independent streak, is that I learned recently, really, that the Appalachian people during the Civil War in Southwest Virginia and Eastern Tennessee and Western North Carolina, down into South Carolina, there were large areas that were basically Union, that they formed militias and they fought against the Confederacy, even though they were in the middle of it. I mean, so that kind of puts that in a nutshell of being tough and self-reliant. And
yeah, well, I have two relatives, only two photographs from the Civil War era, and the two men in them, my relatives, my ancestors, were wearing Union uniforms.
Yeah, that's something else. Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Ron. It's been fascinating, and I urge everyone to go to Amazon and all the usual places, all your bookstores and so on, and look for author Ron Rash. He's got a number of books of novels and short stories and poetry in print, and so there's a lot to read. I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Well, thank you, Court, for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.